Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, from time to time, we do a show here on American Variety in an informal theme that I call Women in Science. You know, and really, it seems a shame to have a special category of women in science. It ought to be just scientists, right? But the reality is that, as in many professions, until recent times, women took a backseat to men in terms of opportunity and especially recognition for their achievements. We've done a number of shows on women who achieved great things in their field, but were basically pushed aside by men who took the credit. An example was Elizabeth Friedman, who invented modern code breaking after World War I, but whose husband took credit for it, so that she's basically unknown today. Our show today is about a similar situation in the field of astronomy and astrophysics, in which a young woman named Cecilia Payne, in 1925, figured out the gaseous makeup of stars. But because her discovery ran counter to the established belief of established astrophysicists at the time, and she was a woman, her conclusions were ignored. But she persevered. That's part of her personality that we're going to explore. And her work on the cosmic makeup of the universe and the nature of variable stars in particular is now seen as being foundational to modern astrophysics. Even so, I had never heard of her. And in my work, I know at least the names of many leading astronomers and astrophysicists. So we're going to do our part today to make her a little more visible. Here with us today to tell us about Cecilia Payne and her work and life is Dr. Avi Loeb, who is the director of the Institute for Theory and Computation at Harvard University and was for many years the chair of Harvard's Department of Astronomy. Welcome, Dr. Loeb.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on. Can we call you Avi?
Of course.
Good. So first, Avi, why don't you tell us a little bit about Cecilia Payne's early life, like when and where was she born? What was her family like?
She was born in Wendover, England, and studied in various places. And the most transformative experience she had was at age 19. She was born in 1900, and in 1919, she heard a lecture by Arthur Eddington, who went to the west coast of Africa to observe stars near solar eclipse as a test of Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity. And Cecilia heard the talk and said that the result was a complete transformation of my world picture. Mm. And she decided to pursue astronomy. And as a result of that, she went on to attend the studies in astronomy in Cambridge, Massachusetts. But at the time, it wasn't possible to do a PhD in astronomy. Hers was to become the first one. And moreover, Harvard University did not admit female students. So she went to Radcliffe, where she worked on her thesis.
Yeah, so actually, she couldn't even get a job in Cambridge. And so she came to Harvard basically looking for work, where they did offer her a small stipend. And as you said, she had to enroll in Radcliffe, which was Harvard's basically adjunct college for women at the time. So her original breakthrough regarding the composition of stars came in her 1925 doctoral thesis, when I guess she was 25. Not too many of our listeners are astrophysicists. I think that's not an overstatement. So in layman's terms, what was it? What was her discovery?
Well, it was a foundational realization, because at the time, the mainstream of astronomers thought that, in fact, the sun is made of the same composition as Earth, because it was natural to assume that the Earth was made out of the debris left over from the formation of the sun. And we can tell that most of the Earth is iron, and the sun was assumed to be the same. And what was really transformative for her is the emergence of quantum mechanics in the early 1920s. So that was exactly a century ago. And as a result of the understanding of the atomic structure of matter in the context of quantum mechanics, there was a new equation, a new formula that provided the abundance of various states of atoms. Atoms can lose some of their electrons, and as a result, they would have different spectral lines according to quantum mechanics. So she used the observed spectral lines from the sun in order to figure out the relative abundances of different constituents. And that includes not just elements, but different ionization states of elements. Elements that lost one electron, two electrons, three electrons, and so forth. And this equation that she used, the Saha equation that was developed by an Indian physicist at the time, was instrumental because she was able to conclude that, in fact, hydrogen is the most abundant element in the sun. It's not on Earth. I mean, obviously, hydrogen is part of the water molecules. We see water on Earth, but water makes a minor contribution to the mass budget of Earth. And however, in the sun, it looked as if, you know, most of the matter is hydrogen. And that was startling. As it turns out, in retrospect, this is true for the universe at large. Hydrogen came out of the Big Bang, when the universe was hot and dense. And as the universe expanded, after the first few minutes, there were some heavier elements made. That includes helium, roughly 24% by mass, and some residual amounts of heavier elements like lithium. But no heavy elements were made in the Big Bang. And people thought, they didn't realize that. They thought that all these heavy elements existed the way we find them here on Earth. But in retrospect, what she discovered is indeed an outcome of the Big Bang. And then stars are made from the material that was left out of the Big Bang. And of course, there is some fusion in the interiors of stars. And so you get more heavy elements. In fact, most of the heavy elements we see on Earth were cooked in the interiors of stars. And the sun is not an early star. It's relatively late in its formation. It formed only in the last one third of cosmic history. So the sun already incorporates some heavy elements that were produced in the interiors of previous generations of stars. But hydrogen is still most of the mass of the sun. And, you know, these heavier elements that were cooked in the interiors of previous stars make up only 2% of the mass of the sun. This was heresy at the time. The mainstream did not imagine that. And she realized it just following the laws of quantum mechanics. And that was revolutionary. And when her thesis was reviewed during her defense, there were several very distinguished members of the PhD committee, among them Henry Norris Russell. He was the director of the observatory at Princeton at the time, and he argued that she must be wrong. And because she was just a student at the time and also a woman, he dissuaded her from including this conclusion in her thesis. And nevertheless, in retrospect, he was wrong.
Yeah, I read that she was forced to put a caveat in her thesis that said her results were, quote, almost certainly not real. But it was funny that she left a little wiggle room with the word almost because she knew she was right. But she had to kind of kowtow to the established big men in the field. And this is a case, as often happens, of a young open mind taking a fresh view of things that are the conventional established wisdom and saying, no, that's wrong. But you have to then break through the conventional wisdom, which is well established. You know, it's like a mountain you have to kind of tunnel through. And she did that. So you said that Henry Norris Russell, who was, I guess, the dean of American astronomers at the time, later confirmed her findings in a separate analysis. And I think he took all the credit for it at that point. So how long did that situation last?
Well, it took him, indeed, he wanted to just check, and he collected more data and did the analysis, and after 5 years, published a paper that basically confirmed what she said. Mm. And, you know, late in her career, she said that there is no joy more intense than that of coming upon a fact that cannot be understood in terms of currently accepted ideas. Mm-hmm. And the whole point of doing science is that we should be guided by evidence. And she demonstrated that without prejudice. However, there is this tendency of experts, people that have controlled the field for a while, to tie up the old ideas with their ego. And right. When a young person comes along and says something different, they will dismiss the young person. First, because the young person is not established, therefore it's an easier target. But more importantly, because they build their stature on false narratives from the past. So they cannot give up so easily on them. And that happened many times throughout the history of science. In this case, it's significant because She wrote the first PhD thesis in astronomy at Radcliffe, Harvard. Mm-hmm. And moreover, she was a woman. And this is really a Nobel-worthy discovery, but she was not awarded the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, wouldn't have awarded anything for a long time. I mean, it was years later, once all of this settled out and the significance of it was recognized, that a leading astronomer called it the most brilliant PhD thesis ever written in astronomy. And yet at the time, it was just swatted aside like a fly. And when Russell did finally confirm the finding and kind of took the discovery to himself, he did note her earlier discovery in like a brief footnote practically and blew by it, hoping no one would notice.
So yeah. That's the way these things work. I've been at Harvard University for 32 years. I also served for 9 years as chair of the Harvard Astronomy Department. And I'm very proud to follow on Cecilia Payne, who also later on in her career received the first professorship awarded to a woman at the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. And later on, she became the department chair. But she lived in the same town that I live in, Lexington, Massachusetts. And I very much feel inspired by the path that she took. Just a week ago, I told the first-year students at the Harvard College, never pretend to be the adult in the room. Maintain your childhood curiosity. It's really important in the context of science to be guided by evidence and not by the elder statesman of the field.
Yeah, I mean, looking back at it, it boggles your mind in today's context how women were treated at the time. I mean, although she taught many astronomy courses at Harvard, her name was actually missing from the course catalog. And the then Harvard president, Abbot Lawrence Lowell, I read, had declared that because she was a woman, Miss Payne should never have a position in the university as long as he was in office. I mean, really? You know? Yeah. So how long did that blockade last until she was given a full professorship at Harvard?
Well, it was 1956, and she was the first woman to attain a full professorship at Harvard. And it's really unfortunate that women were not recognized because they played a crucial role. Actually, even before Cecilia came, there was Henrietta Leavitt, who, under the supervision of Pickering, who was the director of the Harvard College Observatory, discovered a new type of stars that are called Cepheid stars. And they have a period in which they cycle, becoming brighter and fainter. And they also have a luminosity. And there is a luminosity-period relation that she discovered, Henrietta Leavitt. And it's just like having a light bulb. If you know how many watts the light bulb emits based on, in this case, seeing the period of the star, observing it, whereas in the case of a light bulb, you can just read it off, then you can tell how far the light bulb is from you by detecting the flux of radiation that you receive, how bright it is. Mm-hmm. So the farther it is away from you, the fainter it gets. And Henrietta Leavitt realized that this can be a way of measuring distances to stars. And in fact, Edwin Hubble recognized this is a wonderful way of figuring out distances to galaxies. And however, she was not credited with this amazing discovery. Pickering wanted it for himself, and someone nominated her for the Nobel Prize after she passed away. That was too late. At the time, Harlow Shapley received the letter that suggested to nominate her, and he actually proposed in response that he will get nominated because he used Leavitt's relation. All I'm trying to illustrate is there was that early period of the 20th century where women made foundational contributions to astronomy but not recognized. And it's really unfortunate. It's not just that they missed on half of the population of capable scientists. It's more that they didn't give the encouragement, they didn't give the recognition that these amazing scientists deserve.
Even in the case of Cecilia Payne's original discovery in 1925, I think it's the case that when she came to Harvard, there were a number of women in the lab who were basically treated as research associates and who had made hundreds of thousands of observations and photographs of stars. And so Cecilia Payne was able to use that archive or library of information to apply her new insight to it because it existed already. And so she could quickly go through and categorize things, and the pattern of the puzzle began to be clear to her at that point. And she made then the culminating discovery out of it, right? But those, yes, all of those women who were just basically doing, let's call it grunt work in the lab, were people who today would be professors, right? So it's just such a different world, huh?
Yeah, back then they were called computers, and they actually established observational foundation to the Harvard College Observatory, which at the beginning of the 20th century was the leading observatory in the world. I mean, the data was obtained from telescopes in South America, but nevertheless, that was a very prominent place. And unfortunately, the director at the time, Pickering, made also the wrong judgment, saying that there is no need to promote bigger telescopes than were used at the time, bigger than the size of a person, because what can we learn from them? At most, we will be able to see other stars similar to the sun, and we already know everything about the sun, he thought back in the first decade of the 20th century, and he was completely wrong. You know, as of now, astronomers have plans for a nearly 40 meter in diameter telescope, much bigger, 10 times or 20 times bigger than the size of a person. And major discoveries were made over the past century as a result of the biggest telescopes. So indeed, you know, people had prejudices and they were misguided on many things. But the fact that women were not allowed into this club is really disappointing. And in retrospect, science would have evolved much faster and with more discoveries if they were given the opportunity to contribute as much as men.
In every field. Well, you're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Avi Loeb, who is an astronomer at Harvard University and the former chair of the astronomy department there, about a woman named Cecilia Payne, who was a very early astronomer and astrophysicist, first at Cambridge and then at Harvard, who was little known except among astronomers. And she made some groundbreaking discoveries about 100 years ago that, as Dr. Loeb said a minute ago, would probably be Nobel Prize-winning discoveries today, but she was unknown and shoved aside at the time. And so through her own perseverance, she finally, you know, the cream eventually rises with varying degrees of difficulty. And in her case, it was difficult, but it rose, and she became chair of the astronomy department. As Avi said, it was a position he himself later held. But what were, Avi, what were some of her other most notable discoveries?
Yeah, so she later on worked on variable stars. And we know now that most stars have flares, and those with lower masses. In fact, the sun is not a typical star. The most typical stars have a tenth of the mass of the sun, and are 10 times smaller in size, and they flare a lot. And she was studying variable stars. And in fact, that's how she met her husband, Sergei Kapushkin, and later on they had collaboratively worked on variable stars. And she made important contributions also on pairs of stars, binaries. And later in life, she was recognized not only within Harvard with a professorship and being chair of the department, but also the American Astronomical Society gave her the Russell Prize. And in a way, that is ironic, because Henry Norris Russell was the one to block her main discovery. And there is an interesting anecdote about that, because about 2 decades ago, a colleague of mine from the astronomy department took part in the decadal review committee of the Princeton University Observatory, the Department of Astrophysics there. And the chair of that department at the time introduced the history of the department at Princeton and said that, you know, we have a very long tradition that starts with Henry Norris Russell, who discovered that the sun is made of hydrogen. And of course, my colleague corrected him about that. So, you know, this basically, once again, educates us that history depends on who writes it. But gladly, We now all recognize in the written literature that Cecilia Payne was the one to discover this fact.
It's kind of ironic. It reminds me of a saying in Hollywood, once you pop, you never stop. But it can be very hard to pop. You may have to be waiting tables for years before you suddenly get the break that makes you famous. And then after that, everything's easy. So in her case, a similar kind of thing began to happen, that as soon as she was recognized, suddenly the honors and recognitions began to roll in nonstop, you know, so it's...
It also brings up another aspect of this, and that is for every successful Cecilia Payne, there must be many that were suppressed and never made it to the public eye. And these unborn babies are the ones that I'm mostly worried about. Mm. And I wish that academia was more open-minded and welcoming to non-conventional ideas, to innovation. In a way, you know, the tenure system was supposed to secure that fear of job security, insecurity, and allow all practitioners to embark on risky projects, just figuring out what nature is without prejudice and, you know, taking the risk of actually not finding anything or being wrong. But what happens to most people is when they gain stature, just like Henry Norris Russell, they get attached to their own ideas. And as a result of that, they resist new ideas. And the more they resist them, the more they fail in their mission, because science is supposed to be based on evidence. That was the original idea pioneered by Galileo Galilei when he looked through his telescope at the four moons of Jupiter and realized that the Earth is not at the center of the motion of these four moons. The church at the time obviously was very upset about it, but in 1992, they admitted that Galileo was right. 1992 was two decades after humans reached the moon. It's a bit late. That's right. In the case of Henry Norris Russell, you know, it took just 5 years for him to recognize it because he was also a scientist, and he couldn't deny that fact based on analyzing more data with quantum mechanics, which was demonstrably correct. And so he finally admitted that. So my point is that this story repeats in science. In this case, it was also perhaps influenced by the fact that Cecilia was a woman.
Yeah, so is that, 100 years ago, clearly what we've been talking about is an absolute wall for women. But is it still like that, where new ideas from new people, is that kind of entrenched resistance still in evidence from your perspective?
From my perspective, there is resistance, it's obvious, to new ideas, but it's not necessarily tied to who proposes them.
Okay.
So the tendency of dismissing innovation still exists in academia. It's very unfortunate. In fact, Otto Struve, who stated that Cecilia's PhD thesis was the best ever in astronomy, he, in 1952, wrote a short research note saying that if you imagine another star like the Sun with a Jupiter mass planet that is very close to the star, then you could detect the existence of the Jupiter mass planet because it would tug the star back and forth. And also it has a chance of blocking some of the light from the star as it passes in front of it. And this was 1952. Mm-hmm. For more than 40 years, astronomers ignored his suggestion because they said, we know why Jupiter is so far away from the Sun. It cannot form closer to the Sun, therefore we will not waste telescope time in searching for such systems. And then in 1995, there was a hot Jupiter system that was discovered. And after the fact, many more were found, and the Nobel Prize was awarded for that discovery. But if you check the discovery paper, it didn't acknowledge Otto Struve. And it shows you that science is inefficient, because it wasn't too difficult to check his hypothesis with the existing instruments, you know, even decades before the discovery was made. It was prejudice that prevented progress. And you see this story returning again and again, where the general argument is that science should be based on evidence. But then it's also a human endeavor. And the scientist, very often are not seeking the evidence that they have prejudice about. Now, in the case of Henry Norris Russell, once Cecilia broke the paradigm, he was motivated to check the evidence, and he concluded that she was right after 5 years. But more generally, if nobody collects the evidence because people are sure they know the answer, then progress is delayed. And I really hope that we would take an example from the commercial sector, from the business world, where, you know, the biggest companies are obviously investing a fraction of their funds in risky projects. It's always the best way to hedge your bets, because you never know in advance what you might find, and you want to allocate at least 10% of your assets to risky propositions. And, you know, gladly, Cecilia did it on her own because it didn't require a lot of assets. The data was already available. It's just that people thought about it in the wrong way at the time.
Right. Well, Avi, this is probably unfair to ask you because we just have a minute or so left, but I think we've kind of been talking about this the whole time, really, but in a nutshell, if you can, what has been her legacy for astronomy?
Well, I think the biggest legacy, as far as I can tell, is what actually motivates me as a scientist. It's to realize something that was never realized before in human history. She did it, and it's one of the greatest privileges that a scientist can have. In her case, it's what most of the matter, the ordinary matter, that makes the universe is. Okay. What is the nature of the ordinary matter? She realized it's hydrogen. And then, of course, that was understood later on, 3 decades later, in the context of the Big Bang. And, you know, that is the biggest reward that I can imagine for being a scientist.
Yeah. Well, I liked a quote that I read in Harvard Magazine by Jeremy Knowles, then Harvard's Dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, who told an audience in 2002, not too very long ago, every high school student knows that Newton discovered gravity, that Darwin discovered evolution, and even that Einstein discovered relativity. But when it comes to the composition of our universe, the textbooks simply say that the most prevalent element in the universe is hydrogen, as you just said. And no one ever wonders how we know. And as she was then, Payne is today the most famous astronomer you've never heard of. Well, now you've heard of her, listeners.
Yeah, I would like to note on that okay. First of all, Dean Knowles was the dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences that gave me tenure, so I have a very strong connection to his wisdom. But even more importantly, that most of the matter in the universe is still unknown. It's invisible. It doesn't interact with light. And we call it dark matter, but I really am looking forward to the next Cecilia Payne, the person who will realize what most of the matter in the universe, not ordinary matter that we are made of, but what dark matter is made of. And that would be a revolutionary discovery that could upend the standard model of particle physics.
Avi, we're going to have to leave it there. It's been a really fascinating discussion, but I want to thank you so much for being on with us in American Variety.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.